Hey everyone, welcome back to the Period Chats podcast. We have a very special guest today. We have a holistic gynecologist, which is something that you guys have been requesting for the past year and a half. So this is a very awaited episode. We've got Dr. Nathan Riley, and I actually got introduced to Dr. Riley while I was at the Business of Birth Control premiere in Austin, Texas. If you haven't watched that film, I really do recommend watching it. It is very informational. But we're not going to exclusively talk about birth control today. We've actually pulled a bunch of questions from all of you guys that we're going to be answering. And then we'll also talk on some current events as well. But I'm going to pass it over to Dr. Riley so you can introduce yourself, kind of tell us how you got here and, you know, what your perspective is on life right now.
Well, thank you for having me. It's actually a huge pleasure. I don't think we met at the events. It was just really nice to see so many interested people coming out. I mean, it was people of all ages. It was a lot of men in the crowd. It was 20% men. And I thought that was just really, really healthy. We had a big panel discussion. Kim Vanderbeek and Peyton Callahan, one of our mutual friends, moderated a great cast of panelists. And I tried to sit on the end, but of course, a lot of the questions end up being my purview because of my work in women's health. And I'm kind of seen as the enemy. I'm a white, privileged male who had the resources to go through 5 years of college. I took five because I was a Spanish major and had to do all the pre-med stuff on top of that. I took a year abroad, like saw the world, you know, semester at sea. So I had to take 5 years, right? That was paid for because my mom worked for the University of Pittsburgh at the time. So great. I then went to med school and spent 4 years there. And then I went to residency in Kaiser and did 4 years there. And then I did a year of fellowship. And so people see me as a person born from the system, and therefore I emerge as this person who had the finances and the wherewithal to go through all that processing, sacrifice like 15 years of my life and all that training. So having said all of that, and like, woe is the doctor, when you're a white male OBGYN, people think you do things the way that white male OBGYNs do it. And I was very, very easy, you know, quickly disillusioned early on in the process, realizing there are a lot more people out there that know more about birth than doctors. I mean, this is not my purview. Interestingly, that was also what drew me into the work as an OBGYN, is because like, there's this mystique. I don't have to have the right answer to this test. Like, there's something powerful and magical about this. And like, what little kid doesn't like magic? Like something that they can't explain. That's why David Blaine is so popular and all these street magicians and whatnot. So, you know, that the sense of wonderment and awe is something that keeps us curious in life. And that was something that did it. But then you get into training and it's intervention after intervention, as if like nature is our enemy and pregnancy is a disease. And I certainly didn't see it that way. And then if you start going further with that line of questioning, you're like, what are these pills that every woman is taking? Like that I'm giving to maybe 20% of everybody who comes to see me in the clinic. And as you start to dig into that, you start to realize, oh, there are people working as in the world of psychology and mental health who are helping women who've been on birth control. And there are women from like Queen Afua was there, you know, of African descent, and she has this whole womb wisdom course. And, you know, so we're bringing back some of this ancient lost knowledge, but it's coming through the lens of women working in the space, you know, and men working in the space as well. But fortunately, women are now getting that voice and bringing their research into this conversation, where it's not just a woman going to the doctor, getting put on a pill for anything under the sun, and then wondering why they don't feel well. Like there's all these resources out there. And so fortunately, I was on the stage with Sarah Gustafson and Sarah Hill. She's a PhD in mental health. Queen Afua was there. We just had a really, really lovely conversation afterwards. And I'm glad that you were there. I think that it was there were some really, really great questions. And we could have had like an hour long Q&A afterwards, because there are so many questions right now. And I guess that's why I'm here, to answer them.
Yeah, no, we didn't get a chance to meet because we were running late. And then we kind of like jumped in right as it was starting. But what I appreciated was, you know, it is so easy to be like, oh, guys don't understand, guys can't help, like all these doctors suck. Right. And like, it's easy to get, because, you know, if you've had a bad experience with a gynecologist, it's easy to be like, I don't want to go back, I don't want to do this again. So I was like, wow, what a really amazing opportunity to bring someone with so much knowledge, but also so much, like, I don't even want to say like counterculture knowledge. It's not even that. It's just like bringing the old and the new together. So I guess starting with that, you kind of told us like what made you interested in this, but how has it been merging with what you were traditionally taught in school with kind of what you have now seen after being in the practice and working with so many women? Was it hard? Like, what was it like to kind of step out? Because being a dietitian who stepped out of what I was trained in, you get a lot of pushback.
Yeah. So of course the decision's hard, right? You know, you give so much of yourself to being in a profession where you think like, oh my gosh, I've made it. I've made it through. I'm $500,000 in med school debt. Like, so when people out there think doctors are rolling in dough, like there are a couple of specialties, if they didn't have any debt at all, that are, they're just raking in the cash. You know, they're making $1 million a year. But even that $1 million is not Jeff Bezos's $46 billion company, you know? So yes, we make money when we get out. But then there's these golden handcuffs as well, to have the system, to have these policymakers, to have ACOG, which is our college that oversees our guidelines, to have all of those groups helping us succeed and become better surgeons, better birth attendants, et cetera. That sounds like a dream. The problem is it doesn't translate in the reality of what it means to be an OBGYN. So when people think OBGYNs do things for money and this and that, like most OBGYNs are salaried. You get 300 grand a year or whatever. You know, some are made, if you're out in the middle of nowhere, you might make more. If you're in Southern California, you're going to make probably less. And people think that it's like, oh, they want to do these things to make more money. Like, it's actually not it. That used to be it. It used to be male professionals stripping birth care away from midwives back in the day because there was so much profit there from the middle and lower classes who would otherwise be going to the midwives. So they characterized midwives and they developed surgical instruments and outlawed the use of these surgical instruments in birth. It was systematic. And I'm actually working like a 3-hour podcast about this entire piece of history. So you can stay tuned for that. But the reason I bring that up is that it's not just financial anymore. I will say the maternity units on hospitals are probably the biggest money makers, but OBGYNs are not making more money by doing more C-sections. There's a package of money that comes from the insurance company. Use that money however you can throughout the duration of pregnancy all the way up to 6 weeks. There might be some exceptions, but that's generally not what drives it. It's more of having the, being in the hospital system, you have people seeing what you do and they're rewarding you for doing things the way that they do it. And if you do it better, you might make a little bit more money next year. You might get that position as the assistant chair of the department. It looks good on your resume. And this productivity, this desire, these overachievers that are somewhat psychopathic in nature, like me, who went into this thing because of the sacrifice. But we were all seeking power. And when you're in those places, they give you as much power as doctors can wield because you've got their legal team behind you. You can do whatever you want and you'll probably get away with it. Now, the reason that that's relevant to our conversation is that I can give you birth control pills every day. I just keep popping them out. And I have plenty of reasons for which you're not going to be able to sue me or be upset with me. You just find a different doctor. I don't care. I've got 1,000 other patients. Who cares what you have to say? Plus, I only got 6 minutes because the system needs me to be seeing patients left and right in the clinic. So the typical experience for a woman is you go in, you're asked to strip down by some underpaid nurse's aide or medical assistant, whatever. And then you're sitting in this crinkly paper, you've got bright lights, your feet are in cold stirrups. A doctor comes in, barely introduces themselves, shoves a speculum in there, starts feeling around, says little things like little pinch, little pressure, whatever. You don't even really get to know each other. And then before you know it, they've already made the diagnosis. They already know what they're going to give you, which is a birth control pill, and you're out the door. So you don't get that full counseling, the risks, benefits, alternatives. And that's part of the reason that women, as they're starting to meet other women who have had this, are like, why didn't they freaking tell me? And then you watch the film and it's like, doctors are bad people. Like, doctors are not bad people. They're just not incentivized to think critically. And they've got golden handcuffs that are preventing them from pushing back. Because everybody out there in the world of OBGYN doesn't like when a heretical OBGYN goes out and says, guys, birth control pills are hurting people. And it's not just the blood clots and the strokes. It's hurting women, their overall vitality, disconnecting them from nature. And that is important. These are synthetic endocrine disruptors. They mess with the gut. They mess with your immune system. They mess with your nervous system and everything that comes with that. Your endocrine system falls out of whack all because they were trained so well to use this one intervention without ever being thoughtful outside the box. So getting out of that system and having to do things entirely on my own is really hard. But it's also like, if I live for the next 30 years doing things the way that I was told to do it versus what my heart and mind are telling me in relationship with my clients, because you guys are not sick, you're not patients, you're clients, especially if you're pregnant. If I, for the next 30 years, couldn't actually connect with you and treat you like a person because of the golden handcuffs or the system, or I'm just a coward, then that wouldn't feel good to me when I'm laying on my deathbed and I have like my final words, my eulogy is going to read, at least he followed the rules. At least he did what his bosses told him. That's not going to work for me, but that works for a lot of doctors because you've been incentivized for being the highest achiever every single way. We are the cream of the crop. We have gotten the best test scores. We have made a lot of sacrifice. We want to be rewarded. We want to sit on the throne. And stepping down off the throne and giving the throne, let's say, to midwives is an affront to our whole ideology. So I'm not confronted by that. Mostly because my ego was pulverized years ago and I have a wife and two little girls. Even my dog is female. Like, I am surrounded by women who are talking and I'm actually listening. And now I can't unsee it. It's like you can't see the wizard behind the curtain. You know, once you see it, you can't unknow that man in the sky over there above, Oz is not actually real. It's just a dude behind a curtain. That was my experience.
That is I love getting to see the whole experience because I do think it helps people understand what our medical system's actually like, what this looks like, and then what it could look like and what it could be and like the care you could receive. It's interesting. I was camping last weekend and it was like six of us and we were sitting around the fire. It was three women and three men, and we were all explaining. It got brought up because of Friday's ruling. What are your gynecology visits like? And we were all talking. We all had an experience where like we felt like consent had been violated. And the guys sitting around the campfire were like, wait, they do what? Without asking, they do. And like their minds were like blown. Yeah. And they're like, they don't even talk to you about it. They don't even tell you like what they're doing. And so it's cool to see other people changing it and building relationships. And because I think that that's an important thing. I don't think we talk about enough how intimate those visits are.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. I mean, every single thing is a consent. You don't walk into a clinic and there's this implied consent where they can do anything they want to you. It's bad enough that we don't pay staff enough and they're going through their own stuff. We're all human beings trying to help each other get by. And they have to be so efficient that they treat you like cattle. They take you into the exam room. They do check your blood pressure. They ask you questions about domestic abuse. They ask you all these other weird questions, pop you on the scale. Maybe don't even look you in the eyes and then move you on to the next room. Like the cattle, it's like an assembly line. And while it's very efficient for getting as many people seen as possible, it lacks humanity altogether. I can't get to know you if I'm going to, there's a British medical journal that looked at primary care practices and found that patients had like 22 seconds on average to speak about why they're there before the doctor jumped in and already started their workup. So how can I get to know you? I mean, even just birth alone is a really big one, but like, let's talk about fertility or let's talk about how debilitating this pelvic pain is. How do I have any clue what your experience is if I only let you talk for 20 seconds before I interrupt you and start getting to work? So for me, it's like what we need is a flip in paradigm. And you've worked in the hospitals. What we need is a transition back from this fast medicine of I need to be as productive as possible to why am I here? Why are you here? And how can we help each other? How can I be of service to you? You can't do that in a 7-minute visit. That's just not possible. So it's the system at large that's also responsible. The hospital CEOs like UPMC, Jeffrey Romoff made something like $10 million last year. I mean, he stepped down. But these are nonprofit hospital systems. Like the whole thing is set up as a giant business. So it's not me and you chatting about what your needs are. It's I need to fit into the business model. Otherwise, I'm not going to have a job. And then how am I going to pay my debt off? I mean, there's so many facets to this. And being free of that is actually a huge relief for me overall. But it comes with the realities of like now I have to kind of figure out how to run a practice myself and give people all of that time without cutting into my ability to pay my mortgage, So it's complicated.
Very complicated, which that actually brings me. So for the questions we got, we got 10 questions in 10 minutes. And then like now there's even more building up in the DMs that I can see coming through. But the first
question, do rapid fire.
Yeah, we can do rapid fire because the first question is, it fits in perfectly with this. How do you find, an OBGYN or a gynecologist like you? What is like, how do you even search for that on Google? Because we get that question a lot.
Well, there aren't any holistic OBGYNs. That's why I could get away with naming my podcast the Holistic OBGYN Podcast. If you go on like tags on Instagram, you'll find two posts on average. Like it's not a tag that's useful. People aren't putting it out there because they don't practice it. But the bigger question is, what is holism? What does holistic mean? People think that means, instead of using drugs, I'm going to prescribe herbs. Well, that's still allopathic medicine. It's just not pharmaceuticals, it's herbs. So every herbalist out there, if you can in 7 minutes find the problem and then diagnose the herb, you're no different from the doctors. Likewise with a chiropractor. Oh, you have a neck issue. Cracked, you're done. Like there's no whole person care there. Even though chiropractors and herbalists both would probably resonate with more of a holistic approach. But a holistic approach has to include the mental, emotional, and spiritual aspects of a person, period. So sitting on doing a yoni steam is important because there's herbs in there and there's improved pelvic flow because of the steaming practice itself, the hot steam. But it's also an opportunity to put your phone down, to engage in a little bit of meditation and to have you time to look inward, to think about what is this thing that my body's working through? What resources are lacking? What do I need, whether it be from the universe, from my environment, or from my mind, in order for my human being to reharmonize with its surroundings? So when I talk to fertility couples, for example, we're talking maybe 10% of the time about hormones and ultrasounds and all this other nonsense, which is a part of it. But what about the conscious conception process? What, like, are you ready? Is your partner ready? Do you guys have a good relationship? Are you having fun sex? Like, a baby's out there waiting to get into your womb. If you guys are beating up on each other all night with language, with violence, with whatever else, why would the baby want to come into the womb at that time? That's obviously not the case for everybody because babies happen for a variety of reasons. But my point being that if you're going to take a truly holistic approach to caring for anybody for any reason, it's more than just all natural or damn the medical system.
Yeah, I think that's a great answer. It has to work together because if you don't combine all of the different resources we have, you know, it can be impossible to help. So that's a good point. Maybe not the answer everyone wanted is that this is not something that is readily available, but hopefully it's coming and the system is changing.
Ideally, I would also like open up my own medical training program and we would just have like, we would get back to our roots in grounded in holism, meaning your heart, mind, your will, your spirit are all just as important to this, not just pumping you filled with meds or doing surgery. So I'm not saying this so that everybody's like, oh my God, he's the only one. Let's travel to Kentucky. I do everything remotely, but I also can't be the only one. So I have to start actually getting people on board with this idea that there's more to the human experience than the physical mineral body.
Is that in the pipeline to start your own program?
Well, I've been asked to write books. I've been asked to, let's just say it's not in the pipeline. It is a pipe dream right now. But we do want to open a midwifery center, which is going to be called a sanctuary for birth and life, because I'm also a hospice doctor. And demonstrating how people can be cared for through birth and death, I think is a really important part of changing that paradigm. But that would be first. That would be a training grounds for any doctors or midwives or doulas or anybody who wants to be in an immersive, nature immersive birth experience. But that is definitely closer down the timeline than a full-blown medical training program.
Come on, you don't have enough time with running around your practice and being married and having babies.
Yeah, no.
Okay, next rapid fire question. Are women meant to give birth on their backs? Or anyone who gives birth, are they meant to give birth on their backs?
I know this question. I know where it came from. And that is that when you're in the hospital, you're generally told, get on your back and pull your knees up behind your head like pretzel in order to somehow make the baby come out. When you do that, it closes the pelvic outlet. It actually makes it harder to push out your baby in that position. The other issue is that many women are put in that position because it's more comfortable for the doctor to be at the bottom of the bed as opposed to in side lying or on all fours or in runner's pose, whatever. The other thing, of course, means is that we don't permit births in water, so water births in the hospital. So the whole thing in the hospital is to make the doctor and the nursing staff to give them as great of access as possible if interventions were needed. Fortunately, interventions shouldn't be needed, but hey, they're in all stress. Just start putting our hands in there and stretching it out and doing all this other nonsense that a lot of women are like, what the fuck was that? Like, I didn't ask you to do that. I didn't give you consent to do that. But I will say, oh, and then also epidurals. When you have an epidural, it's kind of hard to get on all fours or runner's positions. So many women are getting epidurals. It's kind of just offered as this like beneficent little, you know, little poke in the back and you won't have to feel any of that horrible pain. And for some people, that's great. For other people, they're like, I didn't realize I couldn't move or get into any positions. They force you onto your back because you can't move your lower body. It's a total motor and sensory blockade. I will say, we just had a home birth about 50 feet from here in our house, our second baby 7 months ago. And my wife, we were doing breath work through effigy. Our friend Sarah Tremoli led us at a about an hour after the waters opened. And then our baby came 40 minutes after we started breathwork. So that was less than 2 hours of labor. And she gave birth on our bed, on her back, with the tub completely untouched, pristine in the corner, because the baby just came out. So that's not to say that babies can't be born. What I think we should say is whatever position the mother is comfortable in, it's probably the right position because she can feel there's a nerve being pinched on this side. There's some achiness on this side. Let me change position so it feels better. That's helping the baby get through the canal. So if it's like, oh, 10 centimeters, get on your back and pull your knees up above your head and start pushing and everybody's yelling at you, like there's no wonder that doesn't work very well for many people. But it's not, it doesn't matter where you, how you give birth. If you feel more comfortable on your back, then give birth on your back. It's not my job to tell you what feels right.
I love that. A lot of my friends have recently had babies. I'm like 28 and a lot of us are entering our 30s and it's in my future in the next couple of years. So I'm like always extra invested in like listening to all of these little things because, you know, I think birth is so magical. And if you've never done it yourself or experienced it, it's just this thing that we see on TV that has this like horrible rap almost. So like, I just think it's so magical hearing about all the different things. I'm always like entranced as the birth conversation's happening.
Well, yeah. And I think another part of this, important part of this is that we have lost the ceremony and ritual around birth. Storytelling is so powerful. That's why like podcasts that just feature birth stories are so compelling. It's not that there's a lesson to be learned. We think stories are to be told so that there's a moral at the end. And see, this is why you always leave a note or whatever. That was an Arrested Development reference if anybody's familiar. But this art of storytelling is powerful. A medicine story is a story that helps to manifest or embody our mythology. And through storytelling, we can change the mythology of birth. The problem is that it's something it's too icky to talk about. But telling your birth story to anybody willing to listen is actually a therapeutic closure. It's a ceremony for you as the birthing person or for your partner for that matter. It might be very healing for them. And if doctors would have the time or the willingness to engage in the birth story of somebody who had a birth at home or whatever, their unconscious would start to shift. But we don't care about people's story. We're just caring about profits. And this is not just in medicine. Everybody is just about productivity and profits. It doesn't matter what your industry, just make as much money as possible and sell as many products for as little as you can.
Yes, that is we could have a whole other podcast on that because as someone who's trying to run a business and do it not the way that people are telling me to do it.
Right.
It's exhausting and it's in medicine, it's in business, it's in any of it. Like It's just gotten, that's a whole other podcast. I'll move on to the next rapid fire question so that we can get through them all. Okay. The next question was, and I know that they asked this knowing the answer, but does birth control regulate your cycle?
Okay. So the question about, okay, so let's talk about what a cycle is. I'll try to do this as briefly as I can because it's a tricky.
And we'll link, we have a graph with the, explaining the cycle and I can link it in this podcast. So if people want to dive deeper, they can.
Yeah, let's talk about that because I'd say a growing number of people are coming to me because what they're tired of in their OBGYN clinic is they go to the fertility specialist, the RAI doctors, as I think they used to be called. I don't know what they call themselves now, but used to be reproductive endocrinology and infertility. Very, very few people are infertile, like less than 2%. The problem is that their cycle is probably slightly out of whack. And that could be because they're on birth control. They've got a ton of crap in their food system. They're not sleeping enough. I mean, literally anything. Too much exercise, too little calories. I mean, everything under the sun can impact your cycle, which is why I think it's very appropriate to consider it a vital sign. If you're not having a regular, predictable bleed 12 to 13 times per year, something's going on. It doesn't mean you're broken or you're bad or you're going to die or you've got cancer. It doesn't mean any of those bad things. It just means, hey, I'm not feeling well. It's just like if you weren't sleeping well, huh? Why aren't you sleeping well? You could take this drug that slugs you every night, but like what's going on there? So the cycle, I this is very fresh for me because a very, very dear friend of mine who follows all of my work and whatnot, I asked her how long her cycle was. And she said, it's like 4 to 5 days. So right there, we already have an issue with language. So your cycle is not how many days you're bleeding. That is your period. That is menstruation. The first full day of flow. And every woman listening knows what that means. It's not the spotting. It's like, oh, I got my period. We won't even get into the consistency of that blood, but it should be bright red blood. It shouldn't be clumped. It shouldn't be brown. It should be bright red.
We have a whole podcast on blood consistency. I will link that as well.
Please do, because that is an interesting conversation in and of itself.
It's a whole hour just talking about period blood, so we can list that.
Yeah. So for the sake of brevity, first full day of flow is the first day of your cycle. That starts the period called menstruation, your period. That is not your cycle. You may bleed for 3 days, you may bleed for 7 days, you may bleed for 15 days. If so, that's something we should probably talk about. But let's say that you bleed for 5 days, 4 to 5 days, pretty typical. Fifth day, you're pretty much done. Maybe some spotting, day 6, 7, whatever. But that time, you start to see your cervical mucus starts to change a little. You go from the blood to like a dry, like almost sticky consistency. And that shows that you're entering the follicular phase. So as soon as you start to bleed, you've actually entered the first phase of the cycle. And during that follicular phase, the follicles on multiple follicles in the ovaries are growing. One of them dominates and you've got tons of estrogen soaring now. The big follicle that's going to ovulate is pumping out way more estrogen than the others. It becomes more sensitive to FSH. It just is a self-fulfilling cycle. It pops open, releases an egg because LH from the brain comes down and tells the ovary it's time. Egg pops out. Now we've hit ovulation. So ovulation and menstruation are two distinct things. And ovulation is actually the magic. The period is the aftermath. So now you've got that, I saw the snaps, right?
Everybody, we talk about like this. So our brands, we do education first before product. Yeah. We talk about this all day long. So when I hear like, especially a doctor explaining it like this, it's just like the ultimate happiness.
Well, this is the power, right? Once you know these things, it's like, oh, you can start putting all the pieces together as to why you were counseled to do this, why the birth control may work for certain things. So you've ovulated. You've now entered the luteal phase. And the follicular and luteal phase are different because now you don't have a ton of estrogen. You've got what's remaining is called a corpus luteum from that big follicle that released the egg. It remodels itself and becomes an endocrine gland of its own, secreting high amounts of progesterone. So that urine testing strip looks for one thing. It's the LH surge, which happens immediately before the egg comes. So if you get that test strip that changes, honey, we got to have sex. It's unromantic. It's mathematical. Maybe he just masturbated earlier and he didn't even know it was going to be this week, right? He was going to save up his little spermies. And so now you're back to like, it's the strip change. Let's have sex. In the meantime, throughout that follicular phase, you're getting a change from that sticky, dry mucus to creamier mucus. And you know, if you're a woman and you've paid attention to this before, you will know, because my wife had to educate me on this. I didn't learn this in OBGYN residency, by the way. And then right before ovulation, you're going to get it's going to be stringy, almost like the white of eggs. So very, very distinct changes. And once you see that creamy consistency, you're entering the fertile window. That's when you have sex. Save it up all month, get real frisky the night before, don't have sex though. And then the next day you're going to be raring to go. Bam. That's how conception happens. The sperm can live up to 5 days. They hang out in there. They're swimming around. They're waiting for the egg. The egg comes, one of them outcompetes and bam, you've got a baby. If everything else is working fine. So we've released the egg. So that corpus luteum is producing a bunch of progesterone. The egg is looking for a sperm. If the sperm isn't there, the egg just kind of fizzles away and the corpus luteum fizzles away because we don't need high levels of progesterone. In fact, we need to reinitiate a new cycle. So we get a plummeting of progesterone as that corpus luteum goes away. The egg, of course, is just, it's microscopic. It just vanishes and gets bled out with your cycle. You've got all that estrogen, which built up the lining in the follicular phase. The lining of the uterus now is pretty big and bulky. And at the drop of progesterone, which is like the mortar between the bricks, the wall falls down and you get another bleed, your cycle starts anew. So the question is, how do birth control pills regulate your cycle? They don't. You don't have a cycle on a birth control pill. I don't care what OBGYN fellow of ACOG, they have the same credentials as me. That is abjectly wrong. It means you need to go back and look at your textbook. So the reason it's wrong is that having a monthly bleed requires all of those things I just described. And I only got 1% of all of the endocrine systems that are responsible, the brain, the hypothalamus, pituitary, the thyroid, the adrenals, your gut, your ovaries, everything is working in synchrony for the purpose of you getting pregnant. So if I give you a synthetic hormone disruptor or endocrine disruptor, AKA a birth control pill, but when this applies to all hormonal contraception, we are giving your body fake, synthetic, laboratory-produced estrogen, which is probably carcinogenic in itself, just like every other crappy toxicant that we put on our food, and a synthetic laboratory-created progesterone called progestin. And there's about 100 different progesterone or synthetic progestins, you know, in the market right now. So when we give you the estrogen and the progesterone together, we are basically telling your uterus, grow some, solidify, grow some, solidify with the estrogen and the bricks and the mortar. And then abruptly on week 4 of that package, assuming everybody has a 28-day cycle, that fourth week is a sugar tablet or talcum powder or something. Your body's no longer getting progesterone, just like in the luteal phase. That absence of progesterone causes the lining to shed. The reason it's not the same as cycle is because it isn't a cycle. We are mimicking a 28-day cycle by giving the impression that you're ovulating and menstruating by forcing your body to build up the lining artificially and then telling the body to shed it. So it would be sort of like, it's sort of like me saying, I rode my bike up a mountain. I rode it all the way up there. And then you realize I have an engine on the bike. Like, well, you didn't ride your bike. The engine carried you up there. Like, you didn't really ride up to the top of the mountain. Even though you went from the bottom of the mountain to the top, there was no cycling there. You were just being carried. That's actually a great metaphor because it's cycling.
I was going to say, if that was unintentional, that was an amazing metaphor because it's still about cycling. So I'm very impressed. I think it's interesting to think about it that way. And, you know, with ovulation, there's so many things to unpack there, but like just the fact that these are artificial hormones that, I don't know, there's a lot to unpack there. But with that all being said, now with the new laws that have been passed, I'm in Texas. So we got
I don't know if I love being in Texas right now, though.
I know. It's like not. It's really bad, actually. But a lot of people, we got questions on, like, you know, a lot of people follow us because we do a lot of education on birth control. And this whole thing started because of my horrible experience with birth control. So people are obviously worried now. Okay, well, now I know this birth control is, I think actually it has been labeled as a carcinogen, some of them. We know it causes all these harmful things. We know that it's an endocrine disruptor, but now I'm not really sure what to do next. We got a lot of questions on male birth control.
Yeah.
And I know you have a TikTok video about it too, which we can link.
What are you talking about my vasectomy or are you talking about my...
I feel like, well, any kind of male birth control.
Oh, I did one on birth control, male birth control. Yeah.
Yeah. I think you did both. So we can talk about both, unpack both. Also, you're a champ for hanging out with us. So... You can explain all that on your own.
Just so let's talk about the vasectomy first. So I just looked. I was in the bathroom peeing. I pee too, believe it or not. I have human functions. And I always feel like it's taboo for a person to talk about their bodily functions. Like everybody poops, everybody pees.
We love it here. We talk about all the bodily functions. I'm a dietitian. Yeah. I poop all the time.
So the word cum is going to come up. So if that is a problem for the audience, nope. I apologize. So I was in the bathroom just now and I looked and there's tiny little incisions. They gotta be 2 millimeters. They're like little dimples right on the side of my scrotum on the left and right. The way the vasectomy works is they make that incision, they pull up the vas deferens, which is basically the bridge from the testicles. I think it's the epididymis, honestly, I don't really know. But it connects, it's this tube that connects the sperm in the testicles. It provides a bridge to them to get into the urethra combined with seminal fluid from the prostate. And you get semen. Well, if you blow up that bridge, the sperm are on the other side and they can't get out. The body reabsorbs them. I did so much research on this because I was so worried about irreparably surgically altering my body. Everybody says it can be reversible. The people that say it's reversible, they will still tell you, including my doctor who advertises himself as the best reversal doc in the county or in the state or whatever. He's like, it's not reversible. Don't think about this as reversible because very, very few people can have it reversed. So you might get it reversed. And you might also, you know, I talked to some of my tantric experts and my Ayurvedic friends and my Kundalini friends, and they're like, it may impact the ability for Kundalini to rise in the way that it used to. And I'm not talking about an erection, guys. Like, this is a deeply spiritual practice. If you've experienced it, it is a full-blown sexual experience in your body that might be impacted. So it's like, well... Okay, if I end up going down the path of studying Tantra to my wit's end for the next 50 years, and I'm not able to achieve Kundalini or whatever in the way that these Kundalini masters do, maybe. I don't see that as my path. And if that is my path, then darn it, I made the wrong choice. What I can say is for the next 15 years, my wife is 37 now. For the next 15 years, we will unlikely ever have to worry about that missed period. And the burden has been on her for 15 years prior. We met when we were 15 or 16 and she was on the OrthoEvera patch. I think it's called OrthoNovum now, but it's a patch that goes on your butt cheek. It's not as popular now. But so for us, it was very hard because I am very, very much an advocate for not doing irreparable damage to the body, whether it's through drugs or surgery. And so for me now, I wasn't walking the walk. But when my wife and I had so many conversations, she was so supportive and also sort of resentful at times about me not wanting to do this. I reluctantly initially scheduled the appointment. And then over the next 3 months, I became very wishy-washy. And then a week before this, I was like, I'm keeping the appointment. We're doing it. And yesterday I had it. I had a little lidocaine injection in the sac, in the scrotum sac, in the skin of the scrotum. And that hurts. Like it hurts to be pinched with a needle, but I didn't feel anything otherwise. It took like 10 minutes maybe. And he was talking to me about like whatever distracted me the whole time. And they gave me a Valium, which I've never had before. And I don't like being on anything like that, but and I use other things, but not a pharmaceutical benzo that's highly addictive. So you're kind of out in la la land. And then my wife picked me up and today I feel like 80% back already. So the moral of the story is a vasectomy is a very, very easy option for men. It is not reversible, but we are very, very sure we're going to be we've completed our family with two little girls. I will say that while I was waiting for the appointment, like I made the appointment in February and had to wait until a couple days ago. So you can imagine how long of a wait that is. We got pregnant. I will just say what my experience was because my wife may not be ready to talk about it publicly, but we did. And we were very, very much considering an abortion. We did not want to have more kids. We were being very cautious. We had sex maybe 4 times since the birth of our baby 7 months ago. And it just so happened that we are extremely fertile. So all it took was like a little early swimmer in the pre-cum or something like that made its way in. We just don't know. I generally don't even come inside my wife because it's goopy and gross for her at the end of the night. So there's a lot of information about me. But anyways, we did, but we ended up miscarrying and we saw it as a blessing. We were not inviting this baby in and we asked for a reset and we got it. So there's that. Male birth control is the only other thing apart from condoms, which everybody can agree are not generally very comfortable. But that alone is not a reason to say, hey, it's not comfortable. It's going to be your burden to carry. And society doesn't care about you as a single mom. They see you as whorish, as, you know, you just have this carnal thing you can't control, keep your legs together or whatever. I mean, it's so ridiculous how we treat women who get pregnant with an unwanted pregnancy or an unintended pregnancy, let's say, because nobody doesn't want their baby. Nobody has an abortion because they just hate this little thing inside of them. And they want to kill it. That's how people seem to talk about it. And maybe that's 1% of women. Maybe there's also 1% that are having ectopics and everything else. That leaves 90% of women in the middle who are just concerned about having to carry an unintended pregnancy. So the only other option really, apart from like spermicides and things like that, which are really not something the male can contribute, is the male birth control pill. And the compound that's out there, it's called YCT529. This didn't come up at the business of birth control, or at least I didn't have the opportunity to weigh in. But for those out there who are like, it's men's time to suffer, we actually need less language like that. We actually need men and women to come together on this in a very respectful, compassionate way. And yeah, men, you kind of owe it to women to listen and to actually stop talking and just hear, just listen for a minute, because women need our support in this. And if either side is blaming the other, like we're going to end up in our red and blue bipartisan government that we know works so poorly. So this compound, YCT529, is interesting in that, yes, it is a specifically male contraceptive. It inhibits the ability to create many healthy sperm. But it does this by blocking vitamin A receptors. And the problem with that is just like with other female contraceptive methods, we are looking at one single body system and we are treating it with an extraordinarily toxic substance. So vitamin A is important for brain function, immune system function, bone marrow, you know, production of red and white blood cells. It's important for sperm, yeah. But vitamin A, as you know, is a critical vitamin. So now we're going to block all the receptors, meaning you're going to put somebody into a state of intentional vitamin A deficiency just so that they don't put you at risk for getting pregnant. So when my wife and I were talking about this, like, I don't want to do that. I don't want to do the vasectomy. At first, I didn't. So then I was like, let's do fertility awareness methods. Great. The burden is now back on my wife. And she hasn't been sexually free, free of hormones, free to have sex with me or whoever, whenever she wants. She has never had that freedom. And so for me, it was like, this is the greatest gift I could give to my wife. Yes, maybe that Kundalini master will criticize me later if that's the path I go. But we can now feel completely calm and collected every single cycle. My wife can still use fertility awareness methods to see if she is cycling, to make sure that her health is still intact. And we can have sex any which way, any time of the month, anywhere we are in the world, and not have to worry about it. So the burden is officially off of her. And the collective stress of women in North America specifically over these past 100 years, like, we owe it to them just to do a little bit. And I think very, very little bit would be either you don't have sex with women if you can't control where you put your cum, or you get a vasectomy if your family's complete. And I know that that's a challenging topic for people. I was there. If you have any questions, reach out to me and I will talk to you about it. It was not easy. Up until a week ago, I was determined I wasn't doing it. And so it should be thoughtful. And it required me to do some soul searching. And this is where my soul led me.
I think that is such a good, like, just well thought out answer, and like call to action, like just talking about it, having conversations about this and listening to your partner on either side, because it is a deeply personal and emotional issue. And I was really impressed when I saw so many guys at the Business of Birth Control and I was watching their faces, because it's a lot of stuff. If you've been on the pill or taking any kind of birth control and you watch it, it's a lot of stuff you already know, but watching the men in the room, their faces just like jaws drop open, like mass, just like mind blowing. Like, it just kept happening. So I think talking to your partner or whoever you're having sex with, and it needs to be an open conversation.
Yeah, I totally agree. There were a lot of male hands that went up and we had to get out of the theater. Like, we had, our time was up, so we didn't get to all the Q&A. But one interesting thing that I realized afterwards is two men in particular, one had four young girls, daughters. And the oldest was 13. So she was just starting to menstruate. And he was like, I have no fucking idea how to do this as a dad. So there are people like Peyton Callahan, is who we mentioned before. She has a little ebook. You can go to her website. Maybe we can link that in the show notes.
Yeah, I'll link that.
It's all about a father's role in order to help him understand this, but also perhaps providing some insight as to what your approach might be. And I think like men's groups like are focused on like becoming like 28-year-old, strong, independent, woke men. Like, maybe this is a separate men's group that could be formed. We actually just talk about, hey, we're raising daughters and we're raising little boys. Maybe these little kids need to actually have some sex ed, and we don't have to show them graphic images of penises and vaginas, but just helping them understand, how does this process work? And what are the doctor's options? Like, let's give them the full spoke of, you know, range of options, as opposed to just saying, if you get near a penis, young lady, you're going to get pregnant. That obviously doesn't happen. But when it does happen, it's really, really hard. And our society is like, oh, she was probably wearing a high skirt or being flirtatious. Like, why shouldn't women be flirtatious throughout their whole life? Why shouldn't you guys allow to be able to express your sexuality the way that men do? So, I mean, we've got, this is, again, multifactorial. And for men, I understand and I empathize that, like, this is a touchy subject when we have never been taught ourselves. So I do a lot of fertility education with men as much as I do with women, because the partners come to me and the men have never heard about ovulation and menstruation. They think you're on your rag or whatever else. And it's like, let's just change the language altogether. Let's start educating ourselves so we can better support the women in our lives that we love, our sisters, our moms, our friends, our cousins, and our kids.
Yeah. And it's interesting. So my husband and I have been together a long time too, since I was like 16. And it's been interesting as I've learned more about this. He's also learned about it, because I'm the type of person that when I start learning, I have to tell everyone what I'm learning. And he like said the other day, like, he was like, wow, this is very cool. Like, your body's doing this every day. But then, you know, we were talking on Tuesday at dinner and he was super quiet and he just looked at me and was like, actually, if we stay in Texas, like, I don't think we should have kids right now, because I worry about what would happen to you. And I don't want to put you in a position to do that. So I think starting these conversations with your partners, because he was in the beginning, and like, he wouldn't mind me sharing this, he was like really grossed out with periods. He was really unreceptive to it. We grew up in Alabama. He was just very like, things he had never learned. And so I think if we give men the chance, they might surprise us. It just may take time. Because he surprised me. Now he's all into it. He logs all my symptoms. He uses his name on in like random names on period tracking apps so no one could track it back to me. He's asking me about my cervical mucus. Like he's logging everything. So from someone who saw a tampon and gagged to someone who now is logging cervical mucus, there can be a really beautiful transition.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. What I would love for men out there who are listening or women, if you're listening and you've got a partner in your life, whether it's male or female, it doesn't really matter to me. We have to remember that there's been a characterization of women through the lens of midwifery, actually. Like women were kicked out of healing because of this insistence, which was not true, but insistence by the elite white males, middle and upper class males, that women were not smart enough to study the medical sciences. Their place was in the home, this cult of domesticity. And in that, the church was also like, oh, women, you can be a part of our club. We're not gonna compare you to Eve anymore, but we do need you to be a little more delicate with how you treat your lady parts and your bleeds every month. And you know, we're not gonna say it's gross, but let's just not talk about it. I mean, that became this sort of the cosmology of North America has taught us that women are gross. They're not evil anymore, although maybe we still have certain sects of our society that would honor that. But if anything, they're just like not very, they're kind of unhygienic. You have this gross thing that happens. So even starting the conversation with your penis and semen everywhere is way more gross than a rich monthly bleed. Like I assure you that if you ask your partner, how do you like it when I come all over the sheets and now we're going to bed? Like it's not a great feeling. I can speak from experience.
It's like, yeah, no. It's like instant gag.
Yeah, it's like, this is not fun. Just because they swallow it doesn't mean they like it. Like they're doing that because they love you and you owe it to them to not make them feel like they're gross or unacceptable whenever they're on their period. And while, you know, I'm also not like, I'm kind of cringy about like, let's take our period blood and paint it on the walls and stuff. Like I get it. I'm like, I honor that. Even that's a little bit like, whoa, okay. I'm not going to do that with my semen. Not that they're the same thing, but but I do think that those initiatives are important because it's like, it's just blood. This is a part of my healthy organism. You don't need to be grossed out by it. You don't need to eat it. You don't need to smell it. You just need to honor me for having a healthy cycle. You should be thanking me for caring for my body so that I have a healthy, predictable bleed 13 months per year.
Yeah, that's amazing. Well, we're running out of time. We're already over, but I really appreciate you taking the time to answer some of these questions and just give an alternative perspective. But last question, just for anyone listening, like what would you want them to hear about, you know, like gynecology? And a lot of people have a lot of resistance. So just one final thought to say goodbye. Yeah. It's a hard question, always at the end.
I think we should simultaneously give your doctor a break. You don't go to the hardware store to buy eggs. You don't go to your OBGYN for a comprehensive understanding of health. They are good at two things, pharmaceuticals and surgery. That is it. That's all that they were trained to do. So don't expect more of them. Go and find yourself a holistic OBGYN. You can go to my website, but it's I don't even have the ability to take care of as many people as I would otherwise like to. So give your doctors a break. Remember that if you have a true medical need, and that includes car accidents, or you're pregnant and you have blood gushing out of your vagina, go to your OBGYN. Like go and check things out. But for the most part, you have everything you need through a healthy diet and through honest conversation with a doctor that really sees you as a whole person. So I'm trying to get more people like this. More doctors are slipping into this way of thought. But in the meantime, I'm here for anybody who needs it. Just because you can't afford me doesn't mean you don't get care. I want people to have access. So,
well, thank you for coming on and spending time with us the day after your vasectomy and being really open and transparent. So we really appreciate you coming on.
My pleasure. Thank you.